appreciate having you here. This is the Gender Equality and Environment Panel. That is a huge topic. We're excited to have some great experts who are going to help us talk through some aspects of this. So my name is Lisa Hymas. I am the director of the Climate and Energy Program at Media Matters for America. Women are disproportionately affected by a lot of different environmental problems. At the same time, women are leading many of the most innovative and exciting projects to fight environmental problems. And so we're going to get into some of that. This is a really timely topic. Some of the work of our panels is very much in the Me Too vein. It was just a year ago yesterday that the New York Times published the story about Harvey Weinstein that kicked off what would become the Me Too movement. And today we are likely to see the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice who was credibly accused of sexual assault. On the positive side, yesterday the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to two brave activists who've been fighting violence against women, particularly the use of mass rape as a weapon of war. And I'm really encouraged by that, and I look forward to reading more about them. I didn't have much of a chance yesterday during the panel to read a lot about their work, but I'm looking forward to that. I'll give you a really brief introduction to our panelists. If you want to read more, their bios are on the website, and then they'll each take 5 minutes to introduce their work to you. So to my immediate left, we have Itza Castaneda. She works with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, which is an NGO. She is a special advisor in their Gender and Sustainable Development Program. In the Global Gender Office, she works out of Mexico City. To her left is Anna Smith, who's an assistant editor at High Country News. High Country News, if you don't know it, is a publication that covers environmental issues and land use issues and Native American issues in the American West. They do really good work, and they've been covering what you might call the Me Too movement as it intersects with environmental issues for far longer than 1 year. So they've been doing, and Anna will tell us about her work in this area and some of her colleagues. And off to the far side, we have Etiana Scazzaro. She works for the Sierra Club, directing their program on gender equity and the environment. Anna, as our journalist on the panel, do you want to kick things off and tell the group a little about your work?
Sure. Thank you all for coming, and also shout out to the sole male in the room. I think it's really interesting that there's only one male-identified person in this room. and I think that's a really important part, actually, of the conversation, too, because I was just looking at the description of the panel, and there's things like sexual harassment plagues women at leading U.S. environmental institutions, and that's leaving out men in that, too, which... who is doing the sexual harassment, for example, and who needs to be a part of the conversation. So I just wanted to point that out real quick while it was on my mind. So I'm an assistant editor at High Country News, and I write specifically for the Tribal Affairs Desk. And the reason why I'm on this panel is because I've also been looking into the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because they have very high rates of harassment. About 40% of employees in the Bureau of Indian Affairs answered a survey saying that they had experienced some harassment, not all sexual harassment. There's a lot of different kinds of workplace harassment, but it was the highest rates out of all the federal, or out of all the agencies under Department of Interior, which commissioned the survey. And so to give you more background on that, we really started looking into federal agencies and the intersection with harassment in 2016 in January because of a report that came out specifically about the Grand Canyon and the harassment going on in that national park. And so Lindsay Gilpin, who was at that point an intern with High Country News, she really delved into it, and she spent a year talking with people and kind of found that there was major systemic failures that were failing these women, and their their claims were not being investigated, the very few that were resulting in some kind of action. A lot of times a person who was accused would just be transferred to a different park or something like that, and there really weren't any real consequences coming from those reports. And so a lot of media, I think, was focused on the National Park Service, and so there was a lot of pressure, and there were congressional hearings and stuff like that. So that's why the Department of Interior ended up commissioning this survey to find out how extensive the problem was, and they found that it was very extensive throughout all of their agencies. And so at High Country News, we think that it's really important to cover these things because basically the way that we treat each other has bearing on the way that we treat the world. And so we cover primarily environmental issues, natural resources, and human communities, but some readers have asked the question, like, why are you covering harassment? You're an environmental publication. It doesn't really... thank you. it doesn't really have bearing on grizzly bears or something like that. Like, there's just people who don't really see the connection, and that's true writ large, too. I think some people are like, why are you covering politics? Because they're so very, very narrowly focused. But the reality is that a lot of these, the women in the National Park Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Forest Service, they are... gatekeepers to these natural places that we are all going to enjoy and want to keep healthy. And so it's important that they have a healthy work environment and that they don't have to battle their way through their days at work. They deserve having a safe workplace environment. And so a lot of our reporting in that area has actually had an impact, which is makes it worth it.
That's so great. Yeah. Thank you. Etienne, do you want to tell us about your work at the Sierra Club?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here bright and early. As Lisa said, my name is Etienne. I work at the Sierra Club. I am the director of the Gender Equity and Environment Program, which has been around for about 3 years at the Sierra Club and came about just... shortly, was formally introduced just weeks after the Trump administration won the election. And really thinking about how the women's movement and the environmental movement work together is something that we've been continuing to kind of explore and grow over the course of the past few years. So many of you might have had the opportunity to attend a session yesterday with Rhonda Anderson, who's an exceptional... warrior on environmental justice, and spoke a bit about the internal work within the Sierra Club on equity and inclusion issues, particularly acknowledging the retention rates of women of color within the organization and all of the work that the Sierra Club's been doing to address some internal work. But the work that we do is external, thinking about how our, as the Sierra Club, what is our responsibility to show up on reproductive rights, and women's empowerment and issues like democracy as well, and how that impacts us individually. So the program, as it's structured, thinks about power. And when we talk about feminism, we talk about kind of redefining what power means and looks like within our institutions, and putting women both in leadership but also at the center of considerations of policy. As Lisa said, women are disproportionately impacted by climate change, toxic exposure. A woman globally, say, there's a woman I met in Malawi who had 6 children and lived on an island next to a lake that had been contaminated with cholera. And there was a cholera outbreak in their community, and which was because drought and had impacted the community, and there was a depletion of the water and a concentration of cholera in the water as a result of the reduction in that lake. And so kind of thinking about the complexity of what these women's experiences are at a global context is something that we try to tell those stories about. Also thinking about toxic exposure on pregnant women as a key moment of vulnerability It's also a moment that women often awaken to the realities of the impacts of toxics on our bodies, and are inundated with information through blogs and different resources that they're trying to learn about and protect themselves as an individual, as a consumer, as someone who's choosing what food to eat, and really thinking more about us not as consumers, but as citizens, was something that Annie Leonard said yesterday that really spoke to me. And that's something that our program is attempting to do, is not put the onus on women to decide which makeup is most toxic or least toxic, but really thinking about how we can change an industry to remove toxic pollutants from the products that we use. And I just want to end before we open it up for more conversation with this idea of believing women is really palpable, especially today as women take to the streets and we're expecting the confirmation of Kavanaugh. And it's not just about sexual assault and sexual harassment, but also about the women on the front lines of feeling and experiencing pollutants and harm to our communities. Dr. Mona, in the opening keynote, said that Pediatrics 101 is moms are always right, and because they're seeing the changes in our families and in our communities. Planned Parenthood was one of the first places in Flint to start handing out water filtration kits because their patients were expressing concern about the water, and they were seeing the harm to their patients. So I think Believe Women is something that's not just about sexual assault and sexual harassment, but something that we should be thinking about as environmentalists as well.
Thank you. Good morning. Buenos dias for those that are Spanish speaking. Buenos dias. So I would like to share with you the work that we are doing at IUCN Global Gender Office that is related with gender-based violence and environment. This is a research, and it's based on the definition of gender-based violence that I think it's important to know what we are taking as a definition. We are taking gender-based violence as an umbrella term that includes any harmful threat or act directed to an individual or group based on actual or perceived biological sex, gender identity, and or expression, sexual orientation, and or lack of adherence to very socially construct norms, this is very important, around masculinity and femininity. It is rooted in structural gender inequalities and power imbalances. Gender-based violence is typically characterized, you say, by the use or treat of physical, psychological, sexual, economic, legal, political, social, and other forms of control and or abuse. Gender-based violence impacts individuals across the life course and has direct and indirect costs to families, communities, economies, global public health, and development. And the question is, why are they doing gender-based violence and environment? And that's what we have identified, that there is a gap on the knowledge and understanding how the linkages between gender-based violence and environmental issues are. So we are doing a research that is based in desk research first, and then we made a survey, international survey in three languages, Spanish, French, and English, and we have received around 400 responses, and we also made a call for case studies related to gender-based violence and environment, and we have received around 100 case studies. So it's happening. It's happening. And it's happening around the world. So in the first chapter, we are going to write a chapter introducing what is gender-based violence, as I have said, and what are the international agreements about gender-based violence, about human rights, and those agreements that are related with the international most relevant environmental agreements. As you may know, the Climate Change Convention, the Convention Against the Desertification, and the Convention on Biodiversity, the three of them that are the most relevant have a gender plan, gender action plans. But what is happening with that? Are they implementing in the countries? Are they being implemented? What is happening? I know that you are, and I'm happy that no, it's the first step. But you know what? People doesn't know that this exists. And it is important to know. We are very sad to know that the U.S. government is not anymore part of the Human Rights Council, because some of these treaties and international agreements are followed by the Human Rights Council. And what we are doing is human rights also, because to have a life free of violence is a human right for men and for women. So we are in the second chapter, which is the most important piece of the research. We are trying to establish the links and drivers and examining data and information across the following key environmental sectors and issues. First, women's and men's access to use and control over natural resources in key sectors, for example, forests and biodiversity, energy and infrastructure, water. Also, we are looking for women in natural resource conservation activities. And in this sense, we are working on the sexual harassment at the workplace in the environmental sectors. And we have found, I know your research for that, and we have found that it is not easy to work in conservation for women. And we are also working on the impacts and drivers of environmental degradation, instability, and crisis related with gender-based violence, including response measures, for example, deforestation and land degradation, and of course, climate change and disasters. We do not call them natural disasters. They are not natural. The disasters are social disasters. And okay, we have on time. And I will share later with you, this is the last, what we are doing, and I will focus on that, on environmental human rights defenders.
Yeah. So just to follow up, I was reading a little bit about your research, Itza, and some of the examples of the ways that women are more vulnerable. So, for example, in many developing countries, women are responsible for gathering water or firewood, which might entail them having to travel far from home to do that, particularly as environmental problems worsen. And that puts them in vulnerable situations, further from home or after natural disasters. You know, women, when they're displaced from their home after not natural disasters, unnatural disasters or climate disasters, women, when they're displaced, are again more vulnerable if they're in refugee camps or if they're struggling to find somewhere to stay or if they're responsible for caring for children as well as themselves. I don't know if there are any other examples that you want to give us of situations when women are particularly, like, what makes them more vulnerable?
Okay, I could say that in many countries, including the U.S., where they have an indigenous population, as a commander from Chiapas, Comandante Ramona, died, she said that indigenous women are three times more vulnerable. One, because they are women. Second, because they are indigenous. And third, because they are poor. So vulnerability is linked to many things, not only for being women, it's that you are vulnerable. You are vulnerable because you are analphabet, because you don't know your rights, because you don't know the languages. How to can you express if you are monolingual in these countries that We have different languages, and they can't express what they feel.
Okay. No, that's useful. Let's see. Well, I wanted to ask all of our panelists if there was a particular story of one woman you've encountered in your work that's been meaningful or has stuck with you, or that you think helps to illustrate some of the challenges or some of the solutions. So, and does anybody want to kick off with an example of a woman? Aitiana, we'll call
sure.
on you first.
Yeah.
There's a woman that was featured in Sierra Magazine named Constance from Uganda, who I had the pleasure of hanging out with at the climate summit in San Francisco just a couple weeks ago. And the article's wonderful, and you all should read her story more. She's from a rural community, agriculture, and her story was also featured in Mary Robinson's new book on climate and women as well. But she was talking about how the night that that one night her husband was listening to BBC in their house in Uganda and kind of tapped her on the shoulder and was like, Constance, are you listening to this? And it was that Trump had pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And she couldn't sleep. She prayed. She cried. She called her mom. And was just, she described praying that he would realize the impact not just on her community and her family, but also on the people that he was representing. And to hear this woman from a rural community who was excited to get a plow for her farm and had little else be praying for our leadership to have empathy and understanding, and just the impact of what this our country's responsibility is to act on climate change was really powerful.
Sure. So this doesn't, the woman who I'm thinking of isn't involved with my reporting on harassment, but I just this last summer finally had my feature published after like a year of reporting on this story. And if you want to read it, it's called How the Yurok Tribe is Reclaiming the Klamath River. And the main character in that was, her name is Amy Cordalis, and she's the general counsel for the Yurok tribe. And she's an enrolled tribal member with the Yurok. And it's the first time that the tribe has had a tribal member lead their litigation. And a lot of their litigation is over the Klamath River and water rights and salmon allocation. So that's been, if you know anything about the Klamath River, you know that's kind of like a perennial issue, but it's kind of coming to a head because, first of all, the courts have been consistently recognizing their rights to water and to salmon. And there are four dams on the Klamath River that might be taken down in starting in the year 2020. So that's four out of six dams, which would be the largest dam removal project in the United States. And so after that happens, if it goes through, then that'll mean that all of that stuff has to be renegotiated and looked at again. And it's going to be a massive restoration effort. So I spoke with her about her efforts and using tribal litigation as a tool of sovereignty, and kind of detailed her family, because I think one thing that's really important to note about a lot of Native American families is that it's a multi-generational effort. A lot of these conservation efforts, it wasn't just her, it was her parents, it was her aunts and uncles, it's her grandma and great-grandma and great-great-grandma. And so it was just a really cool story because the Yurok tribe has always been on the Klamath River, unlike some other tribes that were displaced or forcibly removed. They've always been on the Klamath, which is a really powerful thing to write about and to experience when somebody can point to a specific place and say that their great, 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 great grandfather grew up there. So yeah, it was just a really, I felt really honored that she let me into her life and gave me the responsibility of her story. And yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Itza? Well, it's not easy to think just in one woman, but I would like to share with you the story of Francia Marquez. Francia is like France, but that's her name, Francia in Spanish. She's an Afro-Colombian woman of 36, a single mother of two, and she became a leader at her community when she was 13. Now she's 36, and she's one of the seven recipients of this year of the Goldman Prize. And this is incredible because she had started to work when she was really, really young, and doing that, she was using music and dance for making conscience in their community about the environmental problems. And last year, she organized the women from La Toma, which is the name of her community, to stop illegal mining. And they did a walk to make pressure to the Colombian government. They walked 10 days, 80 women, and she was leading these women. And they marched around 350 kilometers from their community to the Bogota, which is the capital, and they win. So the mine was removed, and they paid and did a recompensa. They, how do you say, the
compensate
with equipment and infrastructure to the community. So this is the story of Francia Marquez.
That's excellent. Yeah, if you all don't follow the Goldman Prize, every year they award, I believe it's seven, in seven different regions of the world, and the stories of the people that they find, grassroots activists, are always so inspiring. So this is one of those inspiring women. And another one this year, I believe, was from Flint.
Yeah.
Leanne Walters. So yeah. She had worked to expose the problems with lead and water pollution here, and also won one of those prizes, which is excellent. let's see. I wanted to follow up. So, Anna, you had mentioned that some of, you know, the readers of High Country News said, why are you covering harassment? How is this an environmental problem? Mm-hmm. Atiana, I'm wondering, at the Sierra Club, do you hear from members who are like, why is there a gender program? What does this have to do with, you know, saving bears?
Yes, we do. but I also think that I've been encouraged by the quick understanding and the tremendous overwhelming interest we've had in the program as well. Sierra Club's a grassroots organization. We have over 3 million members, and nearly 200,000 people have taken action specifically on women's issues, reproductive rights, birth control, the Kavanaugh work, and any number of issues specifically related to this program, and that's been hugely encouraging. We also got a standing ovation from the board when we first introduced this program, and I think it's because people realize that especially in this climate, in order to really build power, build a movement, and make impact, we need to be addressing not just environmental issues, but issues that impact us as individuals too, and that's about rights. It's about words, and so it's something that people have really come on board with.
Great. So you feel like when people are skeptical, but oftentimes if you start to explain what it is, they can get it. Mm-hmm. They can understand why it's And I don't know if there's anything you want to add about that. I mean, what sort of a reception has the articles about harassment at High Country News, how then they've been received by readers in general?
I think that like I said before, there definitely have been people that don't see the connection, but there's also been more that are thanking us for covering it.
Yeah.
Because it is an undercover issue, especially when Lindsay first started reporting on it in January 2016. And since then, I mean, Krista Langwa, she also covered the Forest Service and issues there. So, I don't know. It kind of I mean, every time that we do a story, we usually include a tip form, and so we get that kind of feedback too, which is generally more personal and more personal stories, and it shows that, I mean, a lot of, there's just a lot of untold stories out there in this realm of reporting.
Yeah. So I was interested. I saw the tip form on the High Country News site, and I was curious about that, or just what are some of the challenges when you're doing this sort of reporting on sexual harassment or abuse or allegations of it? What have you learned while you've tried to do this type of reporting that might be useful for other journalists?
Yeah, and you guys can feel free to ask specific questions about reporting on this later, too, if I don't answer it now. But one thing that is important is to source manage really well and compassionately. Being a really good listener, and one thing that I've heard a lot of this conference so far is, like, the whole parachuting in to just get what you need and then leaving. Like, that's especially important to not do in these scenarios, because these people are sharing really deep stories with you, and it's just really important to recognize that, and the fact that they don't have to be doing it and they don't have to be reliving that trauma, but they're choosing to do it often because they want to see some kind of change. That being said, you can't promise that that change is going to happen. You can't promise that their story is going to make it into an article, because you just don't know a lot of the time when you're doing that pre-reporting. There is a lot of corroboration that you have to do, and so you have to prepare them for that. You might have to talk to their coworkers from that time period. You will have to FOIA for things. It's being upfront, I guess, about the emotional toll while being as sensitive as you can, I think, is the important thing. And then also being patient. There's a lot of times, like, when you'll talk to a person once and then you'll want to cultivate them and, like, talk more and try to get more details, and they can kind of just disappear because they decided it was too much for them. And that's their call to make. You can kind of do all that you can to try to encourage them and talk about, like, the long run and what you hope to accomplish with it, with their story. And sometimes that is enough for them, and sometimes it's not. So it just depends on the person. And also being patient with the federal government, because because Freedom of Information Acts can just be, like, I mean, they're just endless paperwork, basically. But they're really important, and they can really... They can go a really long ways, basically, in terms of, especially with OIG reports and stuff like that. So figuring out what to FOIA can be really useful, a really useful tool.
Yeah. Have you found that through the online tip form, are you getting useful information, or is it actionable, things that you can follow up on? Or?
Yeah, so I think Lindsay got, like, 60 people through the tip form for the National Park Service. I've gotten 30 for the BIA, at least 30. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
Cool. Thank you. Itza, yesterday when we were chatting, you mentioned a group of women biologists in Columbia,
yeah,
who were organizing and had found that there were challenges to them doing their work. They need to be out in the field, maybe for long stretches in remote places, and that makes them very vulnerable. I was curious if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
This is one of the case studies that we have received after the call that we did, and it's a video about this case study. And this is a group of biologists, also from Colombia. And what they are sharing is that for them, it's very difficult to work as a biologist, because they have to be in isolated places. They have to drive boats. They have to do things that are male things. So they suffer harassment, and in some cases, they have suffered sexual abuse also. And they are discriminated not only in the environmental field, but also in their communities and in their families. They call them las locas, the crazies, because they want to do things that men do. So being a biologist, I am a biologist, it is not easy to work in the field, especially, because sometimes you have to wake up early, or sometimes, for example, for those to take care of the turtles, they have to work during the night. So that is dangerous for women in the field.
Yeah.
So there are no rules, there are no gender policies that gender-based violence policies that protect these women that are working on the forest and in the field.
Yeah, I mean, you know, reviewing all of your work before this panel, I was just, there were just a lot of situations like that I hadn't thought through, like, oh yeah, that, you know, these different things do make women more vulnerable to these, to a lot of different, you know, situations. Etiana, I know you and your program focused some on women in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, about how women in particular were affected by that or are trying to rebound from that.
Sure, yeah. I think that's still playing out. What we know from research is that women after natural disasters, climate disasters, are uniquely vulnerable. Because, as Itza said, women are 70% of the world's poor. They own only about 2% of the land. They may not have a car or have the resources or know that the hurricane is coming or know that because they might not have access to information in the same way. And maybe their spouse, their husband, is in the urban setting going to make some money, and they're left in a more rural environment. And so there's always a confluence of issues that result in people having a physically hard time getting to safety, including, you know, moving your family to safety. And we know that globally, and so we were interested in looking in Puerto Rico of what that impact was, particularly on women. And what we've done so far are some really powerful stories about kind of both women showing up and cooking for entire communities, as well as being separated from their family, moving to the United States for health care, and some limited understanding of sexual violence against women in the aftermath of these disasters. The one thing I'll say about the violence against women after a natural disaster is that it parallels the culture of violence against women that pre-exists in those cultures. So so we always see a spike, but it's always relative to the existing culture of harassment or assault that exists, if that makes sense.
let's see. Itza, I wanted to ask you about maybe interactions that you've had with journalists about the kind of work that you've been doing or some of the challenges that journalists face in Mexico, where you're from. Or
okay. Okay. Well, I can start saying that Mexico is the second most dangerous country in Latin America for journalists. And not only for journalists that are writing of violence in general, but also for journalists that are writing on environmental social problems. And according to a report of, I don't know if you know, that the Reporters Without Borders,
Yes,
since the beginning of this century in Mexico, there has been 136 reporters killed. And this year we have six journalists and reporters killed. And what is worse is that around 21 reporters have been missing. So they are disappeared. We have a terrible situation for journalists.
Just this year.
Yeah.
Just this year.
This year is. Yeah. You can find the data in the Reporters Without Borders. And, we have not make a gender analysis. But we know, for example, there is a paradigmatic case of a woman, and they are working at the very local level. These journalists and photojournalists are not the famous, are those that are working at the local level. So they are documenting what is happening with extractivism, with mining, with illegal issues, not only drugs, but illegal traffic of species, illegal fisheries, illegal environmental issues. They are documenting this. And because of that, they are being persecuted, you say?
Yeah.
Persecuted and killed. So I will take this opportunity to ask you to support the journalists of Mexico that are working on these issues. And if you see the Global Witness report that it's made with The Guardian, they are reporting the environmental rights defenders that have been killed since 2015, I think. You can see what Global Witness report. They mention that many of them are also journalists that are communicating what is happening. And who kills them? Well, the big corporations, the state, the cartels, they kill them. It's not a good news, but it's the reality in our country and in Latin America. It is not only in Mexico. In Brazil, in Colombia, it's also happening the same.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go in a little bit of a different direction. Etiana, a question for you. I saw that your program, Gender Equity in the Environment, talks not only about women, but also about LGBTQ communities. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that and the intersections there.
Sure, yeah. And I appreciate you acknowledging it's not just women, and it's not just men either. Gender spectrum, people who identify as women, as men. And it is kind of is part of the vernacular that we try to include in our work, but also thinking about, I mean, there's so little known about LGBTQ folks being persecuted or impacted or vulnerable in a global setting, just as there's very little on women, there's virtually nothing on LGBTQ folks. And so what we've done is try to kind of elevate those issues. I mean, it's not for good reason, but I mean, in some settings, it's illegal to identify as queer. And so it makes it hard to then have any understanding of how the people are being impacted. In the more domestic side, there is a group called Pride Outside that we're a part of, being housed currently with the Wilderness Society, and a growing collaborative of groups that individuals who go hiking outside and like doing that with people that identify similarly. And there's a conference that happens that we participate in. And then the Sierra Club is often the recycle team for Pride Month or Pride parades throughout the United States, too. And so we've been developing some good swag on our...
nice.
Yeah. So that's just a bit of our work.
Okay, thank you. Well, I wanted to open it up for questions from you all. We want to, SCJ likes to give preference for questions to people who are members of SCJ or are working journalists. Anyway, if when you ask a question, please tell us who you are, what organization you're with, or what you do. We want to be able to keep the conversation going and get as many questions as we can, so keep preamble brief. How about like 2 sentences of preamble before you get to the question? But anyway, yeah, I want to open that up.
I'll do that. my name is Emily Hopkins. I'm an environmental reporter at the Indianapolis Star. The question's for Anna. I guess I'm just curious how the first, noodle of that of the harassment stories get started. So I'm wondering, was it a tip? Was it just a suspicion? How did you get started?
Okay, I'm going to repeat that question because we're recording this. So just a question for Anna about what was the very beginning of reporting on some of the sexual harassment work that you and your colleagues have done, or what kicked it off?
For Lindsay, I believe that was, so she did the reporting on the National Park Service, and that was a report from the Office of Inspector General from the Department of Interior. And so that was the very beginning. They issued, like, I think a summary or some kind of report that she started her reporting on, and then it just, like, really snowballed from there. And so she wrote some other stories, and then Congress got involved, and they actually included one of her articles in the testimony to point out what a problem it was. A dubious honor. Then for me, it was the ensuing survey that the Department of Interior did. So it was a very federal agency. I guess it was because of federal agencies for the most part. And then the personal stories came from the tip forms from those stories. So I guess you would say that we did some fetchers for those personal stories. So we kind of pointed out that there's a problem. People could read the article and be like, wow, that's me. Like, I am that statistic. And then contacted us to tell us their story.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. Woman in the white.
Hi, I'm Zoe Schlinger. I'm from Quartz, based in New York. Thank you. This is a terrific panel. This is a question for you, Dot. I'm curious about the women biologists in Colombia. I think you said are working on turtles. Can you tell us anything else? Maybe the name of their group?
Oh yeah, well, it's a question asking about asking Itza about biologists working in Colombia on turtles. Do you know the name of their organization or how she could find out more information?
I can give you the link to the video.
Okay, that would be great.
Yes, I have the video here.
Okay, great. Here in the front row.
Hi, Sarah Bowman, also an environmental reporter with the Indianapolis Star. You know, at the beginning, you were kind of mentioning, a few of you, but Anna, you also mentioned this, you know, kind of commenting on the representation of people here in the audience and, you know, that it's important to have men be a part of this conversation and working, you know, and moving forward. How do we get,
engage,
men involved in this? And you know, have you found situations where they've been receptive of, you know, in the reporting that you've done or the work that you all have done, or do you find that they're kind of, you know, closed off to it?
So to repeat the question from the audience, how do we get more men involved in this?
I'll go ahead and start. I think one way is framing it like that. For example, in the survey that the Department of Interior commissioned, it was very clear that the harassers were older men in power. Mm-hmm. That was just like, that's what the numbers said. And so when reporting on that, it's important to point that out. These women aren't, you know, being harassed, like divorced from any like real person. Like there's a real person doing the harassment. So it's like, so who's doing it? I feel like we have all these statistics on assault, harassment, rape, and how that affects women. It also does affect men. But it's like, well, who is the other equation? Like, what is the percentage of rapists then? What is the percentage of harassers then? And so I think obviously we don't have the data on that because that's a
survey that probably nobody would answer. But I just think it's important that when reporting on it, to keep that in mind and not use the passive voice when talking about women being harassed or assaulted.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would add is reading your stories and your colleagues' stories, there were men who were sources of the stories who were trying to raise awareness
totally.
About these problems within the agencies who didn't like what they were seeing, the way their colleagues were being treated.
So
there were certainly some good concerned men who were trying to change the culture as well.
Yeah, and they've been stonewalled as well. Like Equal Employment, what is it called? Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC. That's like where these complaints go through. And there, I've talked with men who have tried to get workplace harassment cases moved through, and they're also stonewalled. So it's definitely not like gendered in that way. It's just like an overall when it comes to federal agencies sometimes.
Can I
sorry, I feel like I just talked a long time.
That's good.
Okay. When I worked for the Ministry of the Environment in Mexico, I was in charge of the gender office, and we did two strategies for involve more colleagues from the ministry. One, we did a campaign asking why not saying why yes, but why not being part of gender equality? And ask them, all the people, men and women, why not? Not just saying being. And the second one was showing how environmental projects could be more successful if they involve half of the population. Because the knowledge on biodiversity, the knowledge on managing resources is different, and they will be more successful. Those were two strategies that we used to involve men as well.
Okay, thanks.
I also think, I've been thinking about the Black Lives Matter movement and how fragile whiteness relates to fragile masculinity, and how do we unpack and show up authentically and learn and relearn how we work in relationship with one another. And I think having space, so about 25, 30 Sierra Club staff and board members, men, are going to be attending a one-day conference called the Better Man Conference in a few weeks. And it was people self-identified as being interested in attending, and it's about reimagining masculinity and what it means to show up as a male ally. And part of me thinks that having these male spaces to really talk about these issues, and as someone who might be interested in exploring it, is one way of going about it too.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yes. Question.
Yeah. Thanks so much. This has been great. My name is Julia Rose, and I'm a freelancer in Portland, Oregon. So you guys have talked a lot about the challenges and vulnerabilities that women face, but I was curious if you could also, if there are ways in which women have sort of a unique opportunity to affect environmental change by being, like, in developing countries, like people who collect water and work the land, and in developed countries, like, maybe they buy the groceries. I don't know. Are there ways in which women can have like be a part of the solution around their programs that you're aware of?
Yeah, so to repeat that question, we've talked about how women are vulnerable in many ways, but what are the ways that they have opportunities and power to help change things?
I'd say, so in the state, I mean, I think this idea of women buy 70% of the goods and our purchasing power is something that's kind of ingrained in us, like, oh, well, the way we buy and the way is where women hold their power, and I think that ultimately undercuts our power. We're not just consumers, and working as citizens, working as advocates, working with our governments, and to really try and change the system. And so, I mean, there's a group called Moms Clean Air Force that's run by the Environmental Defense Fund that had reached over the million mark, and I think so. Women as moms is a clear identity that people feel galvanized around and showing up for their kids, and that's been really powerful. But mom or not, I think showing up as a citizen is really where change can happen.
Yeah, I would add that, this year is the midterms. We're seeing a lot of women running for office. We're seeing a lot of Native women running for office. Just a little background, Native Americans weren't given the right to vote federally until 1924. They weren't able to vote in state elections until 1948. So it's, and now we're seeing this year like 100 plus Native Americans running for office. And so that's, I think, a really exciting thing to see. And I think that it's a really vital part of the process is women gaining political power, more political power, and being able to make change that way.
I just want to say that I agree with both of you and with Anna, because participation not only at the high level, but at the local level also. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very important. And for example, in my country, in Mexico, the organization for land tenure is very complicated, and women have no decisions. So how can they take a decision about climate change if they are not the owners of the land? So we have to think on that. The ownership and participation are interlinked to take decisions about the conservation, adaptation, and mitigation.
Any other questions?
Yes.
I'm Krista George. I'm also from Portland and also a freelancer. One of you said this is mostly white men in power that are harassing people. I'm wondering if you think it's generational. And therefore, may pass at some time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do we think? Does Anna think the harassment of women is generational right now? Many of the perpetrators have been older white men.
I do think that we're seeing a generational shift in the way that people are thinking about these things. I mean, in the last 2 years, I feel like there's been a massive shift in the way that we talk about these things. Like I mentioned before, like the first reporting that Lindsay did for the National Park Service was before Trump, before Weinstein, before that kind of came launched into the national conversation. And I feel like now it's like a normal thing to write about. Like, you can write about it. People aren't like, what are you doing? So I guess I don't know. I mean, it would be great if that were the case. And after that generation passes, that it's donezo. But I think it's like an ongoing conversation. And I think it has a lot to do with what we teach our younger generations and what kind of, yeah. I think that we have for a long time put the onus on women and what women should be doing, but I think we should also be putting it on our young men and how they should be treating young women. So,
yeah. Thanks. Any more questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
I'm Rebecca Bright. I'm from Island Press in Washington, D.C. And you talked about wanting to avoid the kind of parachuting into communities and then speaking with people and impacting their lives and then just jumping out. I wonder if you could talk about kind of a positive example of where you or someone else, another group, has been able to build really good connections and create a lasting impact and avoid that jumping in and jumping out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so how do you avoid journalists just parachuting into a community, leaving, and not engaging anymore?
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of feel like I have a luxurious situation because I write for a magazine that publishes twice monthly, and I got to work on that story I mentioned earlier on the Klamath for a year. So that's like, different journalists have different scenarios, obviously, as you know. So I would bring up Amy and talk about how I was able to visit her in Northern California four times and meet her extended family and just hang out on the Yurok Reservation for like 5 days at a time. And that's something that was really important because you end up getting to have conversations that you just would not even touch the surface of if you were just doing it over the phone or if you came one time. That kind of repeated interest shows that you are devoted to telling that person's story accurately and fairly, and that doesn't go unnoticed. And so, yeah, and I think also checking back up after you do a story and seeing if you got it right and seeing what they thought. Obviously, sometimes people aren't happy with what's written about them, but a lot of times they can tell if it was fair or not. And so I think that also shows that you care and that you're committed to that community because you wanted to tell their story right, and that you're following up with them afterwards. So, yeah, it is hard because it is a big time and resources question. But I think when I'm thinking about that parachuting thing, I'm thinking of a lot of like national media that do have the resources, but they don't maybe have the time. I don't know, but they kind of jump in and out, and then that community might be left feeling like they weren't accurately represented, but they wouldn't know because they don't check back in. Does that answer your question? I don't know. Yeah, we're dispersed across the West now, so we're able to do on-the-ground reporting in a way that other national aren't able to do because they aren't necessarily next to the communities that they're reporting on. But as a non-Native writer writing about Indigenous issues, it's like a big deal to me to be able to spend the time with a person, whether it's on the phone or in person. I think people understand that you don't have all the time in the world, and so you're doing what you can to talk with them and get to know their story.
Yeah. Any more questions? That means I get to ask another one. Etiana, your program is interested in helping the clean energy industry be more friendly to women, and I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. An initiative I'm really excited about. So the Sierra Club institutionally is deeply invested in seeing the clean energy sector grow. We have a Ready for 100 campaign working towards 100% clean energy. And I was thinking a lot about the programmer culture in the tech industry and how problematic it was and how the media actually played a big role in putting a spotlight on it, and there was a huge shift quickly to having a lot of really impressive policies, like harassment policies, paid family leave policies, and other policies to really shift the culture. And the clean energy sector, you would presume, is a pretty progressive sector. They're committed to clean energy. However, what we found is that many of the clean energy companies don't have paid family leave policies, and including, you know, a Danish company in the United States is just following kind of the status quo of what's required of them, which is no paid family leave in the United States. And so what we're doing is working internally with staff in clean energy companies who are interested in seeing their company adopt a paid family leave policy. We provide them templates and resources for them to approach their bosses and advocate internally. So we've already seen a couple wins, and then hopefully we'll see a really big shift in adoption once it becomes the norm and once it's something that they see as drawing the best and the brightest candidates for their work. So,
great, very cool. Let's see.
So one thing that I didn't get to was a part of the conversation of the, I guess now we're calling it the Me Too movement, that is not covered so much is the missing and murdered Indigenous women crisis. And since we speak in hashtags now, it's hashtag MMIW. And that is something that needs more coverage, basically. It's a nationwide crisis. There's no authoritative database of these women who go missing, and it does have to do with environmental issues. We were talking yesterday about on the Fort Berthold Reservation and the difficulties when it comes to oil extraction and these kinds of violence against women. So if you're interested in that, I would encourage you to look that up and do more research on it and maybe reporting on it.
Yeah, I mean, so one area there is North Dakota is having a huge fracking and oil boom. They have a lot of men from all around the country who are sort of temporarily based there working in that industry, and that makes local women very vulnerable mm-hmm. to those, the guys from the man camps who are working on the
Yeah,
oil fields.
And one Native writer who's been doing a really good job of covering it is Jacqueline Keeler. So she's, if you want to look up her stuff, she wrote a story for us earlier this year about Olivia Lone Bear and her story.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to end by asking you all something. We've talked about some really difficult problems, but what is something in your work that is inspiring you or giving you hope that we can go out on a high note with?
The first thing that came to mind was the second annual Women's March. Totally blew me away. You think that the number of women that showed up on the streets the day after the president's inauguration was a moment in time and historic, which it was, but I think the number of women who took to the streets a year later, and there's already conversations about a women's march again this January that'll be taking place across the country, means that there's real power there, there's real interest, there's commitment, and I'm inspired by each and every person who gets to the streets.
I tried thinking of a good answer to this question, and I couldn't come up with anything. Because if it's not one thing, then it's always climate change. So, I think the thing that's inspiring most of all is just that people, sorry, I'm trying to come up with something helpful.
It's okay, we can skip you and go to Ethan
like,
if we want.
I guess just like getting up and doing the work. I mean, there's so much work to be done, and people are doing it. And I feel really honored that I get to do it. So,
yeah. Okay.
We'll leave it there.
Well, it could sound contradictory, but what inspires me is the resistance of people, of women that are fighting against environmental destruction. That is, for me, the inspiration for my work. And there are many names of women around the world. And also there are women that now are in an international position. Last night we were talking about Victoria Tauli, which is from Philippines. And now she's the special rapporteur for indigenous people. And she's working on defending indigenous women worldwide. And she, for me, is very, very important. She's a key because she was, how do you say in English? In her country, they said that she was a terrorist because she was defending the land. And now she's the special rapporteur for indigenous people at the United Nations. So, people that are fighting.
Yeah. Thank you. Megan.
Hi, this is Breaking the Rules, because it's a comment, not a question, but it's actually more of a plea. I mean, every year for how many years I've been doing this conference, I've proposed or organized some panel about women, gender, reproductive health, and environment, and there's always one thing. If everybody in this room submitted idea or a panel, a proposal, a dinner, or a lunch, there would be, 15, 20, whatever. So I just ask you guys, because this is a member-driven conference, if you want more of this, submit it, propose it, and we want more.
Cool.
Thank you. And thanks to Megan, who actually organized this panel. All right, well, thank
thank you all for coming. There's some materials up here at the front, I think particularly from the Sierra Club, if you're interested in learning more about their program, or come chat with us. And thank you to our panelists for sharing their expertise.
Thank you.